Have you registered for the Recruitment Coach Live Summit yet? Here's reason number three why this will be the best investment you make in your business in 2025. You'll discover the latest trends. Listen, the recruitment industry is literally changing before our very eyes. What worked 2 years ago or even last year could already be outdated information. If you want to stay current in terms of the technology, the adoption of AI and automation, and the tactics and strategies that are actually working right now in today's marketplace, then you need to get yourself to London on September 17th or 18th. Do not get left behind. Register now at recruitmentcoach.com/summit. Welcome to The Resilient Recruiter. My name is Mark Whitby, and my special guest today is Martin van der Kwak. Martin is a serial entrepreneur in the recruitment industry. He started his first company, Legal Top Talent, while he was still in college. After completing his MBA at INSEAD, Martin co-founded four companies in 4 years. So his companies were The Legal Bench, which is focused on contract lawyers, Consultancy Exit, focused on former top-tier strategy consultants, Apollo Executive Search, which focuses on leadership roles for PE-owned and VC-backed companies, and most recently, Matcher, a sourcing and recruitment outsourcing company based in the Ukraine. All companies are profitable, and despite COVID-19 growing, next to running his companies, Martin invests actively in technology companies, and he's a board member of several startups. Martin, welcome. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Mark. I saw an impressive guest list previous to me joining, so I'm honored to be one of the people on your show.
Oh, brilliant. Well, I'm honored to have you. It's funny, you and I were chatting before we started recording that you didn't like that bio. Your business partner, Adrian, wrote it for you because you don't like to sort of blow your own horn, so to speak, and you consider yourself, you know, more introverted by nature. How does, you know, which may surprise people to hear how successful you've been as an entrepreneur when you consider yourself an introvert. How do you reconcile, you know, being an entrepreneur whilst not being the sort of typical extrovert?
I recently read about the extrovert introvert. So I mean, I can't say that I'm a full introvert, but to some extent, indeed, as we discussed, I am an introvert. I wrote the first draft of my bio, which I sent to my business partner, who said, "Okay, this is not good. This doesn't really reflect what you've done. So I'll rewrite it for you." So I used that one. So I think in general, and that's also already something that I acknowledged fairly quickly, and that I always keep in mind when starting businesses: with whom do I start a business? Because as we discussed, to some extent, I'm an introvert. I don't like being in front of groups. So Thank you for having me on a video podcast, Mark, where the previous ones, I think, were mostly audio. Knowing this about myself, I always select people to start a business with that are extrovert and that are good at like standing in front of groups and motivating people. I did manage teams myself in strategy consulting, but that's professional services. And I think easier. So I'm looking for people who have the strength to complement me, which I think is also for them very, very attractive, because normally you have two extroverts starting companies and sometimes fighting for who can be the CEO. The good thing is I don't want to be the CEO, and I think I'm not the most capable person to be the CEO. I'm capable, I think, of starting businesses and getting them profitable, but I need other people to complement my skills in order for the companies to be successful.
Wow, that's cool. So you're not the CEO of any of your businesses?
No, some of the companies don't have an official CEO, so that makes it easier, but I don't consider myself being the CEO of one of the businesses.
All right. So fantastic self-awareness, Martin, and you know, to recognize what your strengths are and where you need people with complementary skills. So you said that your strength is really starting businesses and getting them profitable. Could we say a little bit about that? Like, what is it about the startup phase and, you know, getting quickly into profit that is attractive to you?
Yeah, this is a very interesting question that I've posed myself a lot as well, because as starting a business comes with a lot of frustration in the beginning, because you know you have a great idea, but the world just doesn't agree yet. You get a lot of no's, you get a lot of sort of very polite no's. Come back in the future. And yes, this is very interesting. We should discuss this at a later stage. That's just a polite form of a no. It does frustrate me a lot at those times. So I've often wondered why indeed do I do this every time again. I think a lot is about proving that there's something different that could work, and the fact that I really believe in it, and then want to show, okay, I'm sure that this could work, and that this could make the sort of in this case most of my active activities as an entrepreneur in the recruitment executive search space, and that things can be better there. And that's especially because I believe in specialization. And I think within the industry, there's a severe lack or a lot of potential for further specialization, and acknowledging that and building businesses there and showing that it works is something that really motivates me despite all the frustrations that go along with it.
So I'd like to dive into the issue of specialization in just a minute. Before we do that, you mentioned to me previously that when you're trying to prove a new business model, and there's a sort of thrill of starting something new, and you know, bringing, you know, innovation or creativity to an overserved market like recruitment, that gives you energy. But you also mentioned it comes with a lot of sort of stress and anxiety. Like, how do you manage that stress and anxiety? Because that, for a lot of people, can be debilitating and sort of shut down your potential.
Yeah. Fair question. And again, also one of the things I'm wondering myself, why do I do this every time again if those feelings come? But then if the feelings come, you still need to cope with them, because there's not really an alternative. So I think part of it now is just getting used to it and growing a thick skin in dealing with it. I think I think I'm also quite capable at putting things in perspective, both the highs and the lows. If things are successful, and I think that's also some part of the perfectionist in myself. And then I think, okay, it still could and should have been better. I mean, even if you win various clients in a month, you also always lose various pitches in a month. At least I don't win everything yet. So then I always think about, okay, what could have been better? So even those things, the highs, I can put in perspective, but I think I can also put the lows in perspective, as I said, partly due to experience, and I think also partly due to the fact that I do a lot of sports, which really helps me to sort of unwind.
Great. That makes a lot of sense. So in other words, you don't get over excited or self-congratulatory when you win a big account, but neither do you take it too hard when you lose a pitch or you have a disappointment. You try and keep a balanced perspective and always analyze, well, how can we improve? What can we do better?
Exactly. And I think the fact that the companies are profitable also and are growing also makes it sort of easier now to deal with the setbacks. But especially in the beginning, indeed, it's harder if you're still trying to bring the companies to growth and profitability. But indeed, the perspective also if I look at where the companies are now after a few years of entrepreneurship, I still see so much potential and things that we should improve, that In a way, I'm happy with where we are, but in a way, I'm also not happy because there's still so much to do.
All right. Fantastic. So mental note to myself, circle back to discuss how to get profitable quickly, because I think this is something I need to learn is focusing on profit and not just, I enjoy the sales and the marketing and business development. That's my strength, but managing operations and you know, finances and cash flow is something that I struggle with. Always remembering that if it's not profitable, then it doesn't matter what your sales are, because, you know, then it's not a successful business. Let's talk a little bit about the idea of specialization. You mentioned to me that, you know, there's a big difference between sourcing and recruitment. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah. So that's something that I find very interesting. But if we take it a bit broader, and if we look at the overall responsibilities of recruiters or executive search consultants or whatever you want to name it, so you have the sourcing activity, you have to engage candidates, you have to assess candidates, you have to manage clients, you have to manage candidates. It's basically project management with a severe part of stakeholder management, but those are so many different type of activities. I sometimes compare the industry to if you would look at the production facility. And if you would have so many different activities in a production facility, you would have a dedicated person for each and every activity. And what do we do in this industry? We say to one person, okay, these are all the activities. Please go ahead and be successful at all of them. And if we specifically, with Matcher, we specifically picked out of all the responsibilities the sourcing part. And if you look at sources and recruiters, very often sourcers have a very technical background, more a data-oriented background. What they need to do is very different from what a recruiter needs to do to be successful. At Matcher, we say we find people and we turn people into candidates. So we are good at market mapping and globally finding the right talent that fits the requirements of our clients, but finding them and then reaching out to them, for which we use over 90 platforms. We use over 20 tools to try to be successful. We try to distinguish ourselves with our conversion rates. And that's a lot of about A/B testing with messages, with tooling to see how can we be successful. And so that's the sourcing part. But then if we look at the recruiting part, when we hand it over to our clients, we need to turn those candidates into hires. It's a lot about building relationships, selling the company, managing the process, both on the internal side as on the external side with the clients. And those require such fundamentally different skills that I do not really understand why many companies still have all these responsibilities within their own recruitment team without specialization within the team.
Wow, that's interesting. I love the analogy of a production facility, and, you know, which it's just logical, right? If you're manufacturing, you know, in the aerospace industry or in the automotive industry, you don't have the same person doing, you know, the design, the production, the engineering, the, you know, all the different parts of the process, right?
Exactly.
Those are different people.
Exactly. And in recruitment, we do.
Right. Yeah. In recruitment, right. We do all, you have one person doing all those different jobs. So how can they possibly do them all, you know, equally well when they're different skill sets? I hadn't thought of it quite that way before. That's interesting.
And that has nothing to do with I mean, the quality of the people or whatever. But some, as I mentioned, I'm not good at being a CEO. So that's why I'm also not everything myself. Depending on the stage the company is in, I'm doing a lot myself. But the further the businesses grow, the more I can focus on what I'm good at. And I think that's really a development that is being made within the industry with various firms, especially firms that have the skill to do so. But I think that's also where still so much potential lies within the industry, Because the good thing is not only you're putting, you're getting focused on activities which will improve the results, but also people will be happier because people will be happiness and being good at your job tends to be correlated. So with recruiters doing sourcing, what they don't like doing, they will most likely not be very good at it, especially also as it's not their dedicated task, but they will also not be happy doing it, which again has impact on your retention, etc. So what we do by sort of having companies outsource the sourcing process is both making the process better and more efficient, but also making the recruiters happier. And what we see is that if we work with freelance recruiters at the companies we work with, and they move to a different company, they say, "Hey, we want to take Matcher along again." Because they think, okay, they make my life better because I get a lot of sourced candidates and I can focus on what I like doing and what I'm good at, managing everything internally to get to hires as soon as possible.
All right. That's cool. Yeah, I like the analogy. So how does this apply in different contexts? For example, you've got a contract recruiting business, you have an executive search business. You know, how does this concept of specialization and trying to remove the redundancy from different tasks apply in those contexts?
Yeah, good question. So my knowledge also developed over the years, Mark. So it wasn't all there when I started that I was sure what I exactly wanted to do and how to build the businesses. So the idea of Matcher basically came from Apollo Executive Search. So the company with which we do C-level hires for private equity owned and venture capital backed companies. So basically what we do there is we hire people. We mostly work with people with a business background. As I think for the C-level roles, it's very important that people really understand what does a business do? What are the challenges in a business? And that the people that hire you consider you your potential peers. So we hire people with a business background that tends to be more expensive as well. So
clarify what you mean, Martin, which is when you say you hire people, do you mean people to work at Apollo Executive Search?
Yeah. So okay. Our executive search consultant. So I mean, our first hire, for example, he studied at Harvard. He did a PhD. He worked at the NATO in international diplomacy. So not your traditional background. Our most recent hire worked in consulting, was CFO at the SaaS firm, and then switched to Apollo. But that's the kind of people that we hire. And those people, where do we see that their strength lies and what did we notice in dealing with clients, in dealing with candidates, because the clients and the candidates consider them their peers. And that's something that's very hard to replicate if you don't have that background. So we noticed, okay, that's where their core strength lie. And then we looked at the whole process that we had. And then it's the interaction with clients and candidates is one part of it. But finding them is another part of it. So we ask ourselves the question, are they the right people to find those candidates? And we said, well, actually, their time is better spent on what they're really good at. So then we looked into the market. So we thought, okay, we can outsource the sourcing and market mapping part of the job. But looking into the market, we came either to sort of the freelance solution via Upwork or whatever, which is often very cost effective, but not sustainable. And often as something is most of the times things are cheap for a reason because the output is also in line with the price. So that was one option, which we were not happy with. And then on the higher end, you also had some solutions which tended to become very expensive because they wanted the percentage of our fees. And you know what the fees are like in executive search. So then it became too expensive for us to work on that model. So we basically noticed, hey, why is there not sort of a sustainable sourcing solution that helps us in sourcing, that helps us in market mapping, but that has the cost structure that is more or less in line with hiring someone ourselves? So basically, the challenge we had at Apollo was the input for the ID for Matcher, and that's when we started Matcher.
Got it. So Matcher was actually born out of a need that you discovered within your executive search business, which is that you've got a high-level client-facing, you know, executive search consultant. Someone who's with a PhD from Harvard isn't the same person, or someone from a consulting background isn't someone who should be sending LinkedIn messages to candidates to try and get them to start a conversation and that sort of thing. It's not maybe the best use of their time.
Exactly. And for two reasons, the results will not be as good as someone who's doing it 100% of his or her time, because the specialization, as I think you have the 10,000-hour rule about activities. And also, if you have those people do sourcing on LinkedIn 24/7, within a month, they will be at your desk saying, okay, I'm not sure I like my job, which would again also be a big pain for us. So they can do what they're good at and what they like.
Great. Oh, that makes total sense. I like it. So there is a big already sort of offshore resourcing industry, if you like. You know, a lot of companies in India, for example, which provide this sort of service. Is that something that you evaluated before trying to tested before setting up Matcher?
Yeah. Yeah, so we tested several solutions indeed out of India and out of Asia. And what we mainly noticed is that the quality is not in line with what you would want the standard that we have with our clients. So there are indeed various initiatives, but none of which really convinced me about the value add that they provided. We also looked at, of course, automation, because if you look at sourcing, the biggest threat is, of course, that sourcing will be automated. And there are so many companies telling about their AI, because everything needs to be AI these days, otherwise it's not tech. So an AI solution to do automated matching and reduce the need for the sourcer. And actually with booking.com was one of our biggest clients pre-corona. And with Booking, we also did a test that we said, okay, we identified one tool which we thought, okay, this might work very well for the automated matching, which had a lot of marketing around it and was supposed to be sort of state of the art. The results were disappointing. It was so, and that has been my experience with all AI automation there's a lot of good marketing about it, around it, but if the results would be in line with the marketing, Matcher would be redundant. But so far, nothing has convinced me yet. And I think what we're doing still has a lot of value. And there are other companies looking into the sourcing space, but it's such a huge space, as so many companies have not identified sourcing as a dedicated skill yet. I think competition is only good. It means that there is a market and it will make the market efficient.
Okay, that's a good way of looking at it. Regarding the automation tools and so on, though, Martin, would it not be fair to say that like where automation is right now is like where the Wright brothers were when they, you know, created the first airplane, right? So, you know, that it's very basic and, you know, is not going to perform as well as a team of intelligent human beings based in the Ukraine. But, you know, maybe in 20 years, it could be a whole different, you know, whole different thing.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's indeed, I mean, though I think I read somewhere that AI was first mentioned in the 80s, there was discussion around it. So if you would then see where are we 40 years later, it's also not that impressive. But there are, of course, various industries in which AI has proven like extremely efficient and successful. Yes. So indeed, in 20 years in the recruitment space, AI might be very successful. So I fully agree with you there. If we make the comparison to the Wright brothers, if we look at AI and automated matching, I think if the planes would have been In line with where AI and automation is now, I would not recommend anyone to jump aboard of that plane and try to cross the...
yeah, you don't want to be the first passenger on that plane.
Exactly. I wouldn't want to be the passenger. Still, also with tooling, there are still a lot of ground to gain with tooling. So we are using over 20 tools, and our automation tooling really brings us a lot. But it's still all on the process side, so making our processes much more efficient. And there we are gaining, I think, in the tens of percentages per year in terms of efficiency. And there are very smart tools for outreaching campaigns, emailing, database management, etc. But if you look at the matching part, that's where there's still a lot of ground to cover.
Okay, interesting. So you said you use 80 different platforms, 20 different tools. What part do you use, let's say, a tool for versus what part does a human being still do?
So basically, we indeed look at the whole process and see where does a human add value. So of course, in the technical sourcing part and combining various databases, you get a lot of value from tooling, because we are faster with finding pools of candidates and also better at getting more elaborate knowledge on those candidates. So that's where we use tooling. But then there needs to be a person, of course, in the beginning to do the input to get the tools to work, but then also to assess the output of the tools to see, okay, what's the output that we can really work with. And so every time there's a judgment, then there's a person again that really needs to be involved. After that, you get to the outreach phase, and in the outreach phase again, there's a lot of tooling that you can do in terms of automated. We work with semi-personalized automated outreaching. So there's especially for tech profiles, you need a high degree of personalization to successfully engage them. So yep, we invest a lot there, but then we try to be smart in leveraging tools to sort of again be more efficient with it. We experiment a lot also now with video outreaches because it's sort of new, and to see, okay, what effect will that have. So then again, in outreaching, in following up, in managing candidates, that's again where we use the tooling. If we start interacting with candidates, I think there's also where AI is getting better, and I've seen some solutions, most of them very expensive, of course, that in the conversational part are getting somewhere, which I consider interesting. But that's, we still do this mostly ourselves.
Okay.
So in all, in judgment and in candidate-facing activities, we do it ourselves. Underlying processes, we try to automate as much as possible.
Got it. So let me just clarify. So the actual... researching to identify candidate pools, you use automation tools there, but of course a human needs to set it going, right? To kick off the process. Then also uncovering more insight and data for those candidates. So, you know, contact information or, you know, stuff like that, you can use automation.
Yeah.
Then the outreach, you can semi-automate that. But then ultimately, someone still has to decide, like, look at the data set and decide which ones are the right candidates to approach, and then set up the automation campaign. And then, you know, the actual matching part, still, that's a human process then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
That's still a human process. And that's where I found all tools. And as it's such a big threat to our business, we test with a lot of them to see what's out there. And that's where I think the market still has a long way to go.
Okay. Let's talk about, this is a tangent, but video outreach, I'm experimenting with that as well. What are your findings? How successful has it been?
Yeah. So my co-founder, Adrian, gave a speech on this on the sourcing summit. Where he explained, so he did basically the testing of this whole video outreaching campaign where we learned a lot of lessons in the beginning because taping the video, it sounds very straightforward. Basically, what you do as a reach out message, you just tape it, you send it out, and we expect success. Fortunately, it didn't prove that that straightforward yet. So in the beginning, we had opening rates of, I think it was below 40%. Response rates even much lower. So we had a lot of difficulty in getting A, it in front of the people's eyes, and then B, getting them to engage with it. But that's where we / Adrian learned a lot about, okay, what can we do? And again, tooling was very helpful there to ensure that it doesn't end up in spam, to ensure it's sent at the most appropriate time, so that we get people to read it, and then testing with what do you do to engage people. So something very nice that is done, but you should watch the Sourcing Summit video also, which goes into detail about it, is also there you have tooling that helps you to personalize the video outreach. So then Adrian was able to record a video where he would send to you, hey, Mark, and then in your screen, you would see your own LinkedIn picture. He would point to you and refer to what you're doing, and you would think, wow, how did he do it? We also offer, to show the value of our sourcing, we offer free sourcing seminars to potential clients or people who just want to see what we do, of 1 or 2 hours in which we show how sourcing works. For those invites, we send sort of a Zoom conference like we are in now, and then you would see the third photograph, which would be a photograph of that person in LinkedIn saying, hey, shouldn't we be on a Zoom call with the three of us to discuss how we could do sourcing? So again, that's where it's a combination that we need to identify that Mark Whitby is a relevant contact for us. But tools then again help us to engage you, so you can see, hey, this is really a personal thing, or I like what they're doing, and maybe I should engage with those guys.
Yeah, absolutely. That's cool. I've certainly found, because I'm experimenting with it as well, and I think it's important that the video has the person's, either their website, their LinkedIn profile, and their name and their picture is prominent, so they know that this video is especially for them. Otherwise, they just think it's a generic, you know, marketing video. They don't realize, without clicking play, they don't realize that you've actually taken the time and trouble to make this video especially for them. So there has to be some visual clue in the, and there has to be a thumbnail of the video that they can see. If it's just a link, they're probably not gonna click it. So
has it been successful for you, Mark, so far?
I'm very interested in it. I haven't measured it like you have. I'd be interested to see, is the talk that Adrian did, is that available, or is that?
I'll share it with you. Potentially you can also add it in the comments when you post this podcast, if more people would find it relevant.
Yeah, I would love to see that, because my clients are, I'm telling my clients, look, try this, because it's still new enough that, you know, I think eventually it will become normal.
Yeah.
But right now you can gain an advantage in getting engagement from candidates or clients. We use it for business development as well. Yeah. But my testing is so limited, I can't really say definitively that this works. Yeah. It's just an idea that I like, because intuitively it seems like it should work, right?
Yeah.
But I'll watch Adrian's video. That's cool.
Yeah, and there's one thing about, because I agree with you that it's new and it's different, and you can really personalize it and speak to the person, which I think would be much more efficient. What we are facing in Kyiv is that not everyone is fully comfortable using it, also from sort of privacy considerations. They are not all of them are very keen to be exposed with a video of themselves towards a candidate. Maybe some people on the recipient side will also consider it intrusive. Not sure yet. I think time will tell. But I think conceptually it's extremely interesting. And with Matcher, we really invest in tooling and trying to stand out. So it's really something we want to move on with.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's cool. We the sort of personalized outreach tool that I use is called Interseller. I don't know if you've looked at that one. But my clients are getting good results with that. But it has to use the personalization. If it's just a mass message, that just goes either gets deleted or ignored. So there has to be we call it automation at scale. It has to, which takes longer. It's easier just to press send and send out hundreds of messages to which are the same, but then. The response will be disappointing. So it takes a little longer to set up the automation, you know, but I always tell people, even if it takes 2 or 3 minutes per email, to look at the person's LinkedIn profile or the website or find something relevant to say that's unique to them, then the corresponding increase in response will be worth the extra effort. Yeah.
When we started with Matcher, we did so especially we targeted the international tech domain. And so when we started, we had targets of people approaching between 100 and 200 people per day, with more a mass outreach campaign with one twist the name and something straightforward about the job or whatever to be sent out. Now our people are on sort of between 20 and 30 outreaches per day, so much lower, but the absolute output is much higher because we really invest in the personalization, like finding out what are their interests on Instagram, referring to those interests with something that is new in that space. But then again, we're looking at, because you need to build skill in the operation, as you mentioned, rightfully so. So then we try to cluster people with a similar interest and with underlying process efficiency. Still try to get to... we call it so semi-personalized automation, to still show people we know who you are, but also ensure we are efficient in our processes.
Right. Okay. It makes total sense. Interesting. So there's a couple of things we kind of skipped over. Like we jumped straight in Matcher because that's like, obviously you're passionate about it and and it is very relevant. But I did want to just talk about your kind of earliest startups. Why did you go into recruitment in the first place?
I always say to people, Mark, when I was very young, I was taking one of my father's best friend. He was a partner at Allen & Overy. I don't know if you know it.
Partner at
Allen & Overy.
Okay.
One of the largest global law firms. I studied both law and economics, my goal was to be a partner in a law firm as soon as possible. Then when I started doing economics, I liked that and the mathematical component of it much more, so I dropped the law ambition and more started to look into strategy consulting. And if at that time you would have told me that in 10 years I would be an entrepreneur in recruitment, I would have considered everyone crazy who would be telling me this. So how did I end up here? It's basically, I think I like people. I like to see what drives people. I like to see people in a right place. And that's why I said I'm an extrovert introvert. I'm good at getting in contact with people, but it shouldn't be the whole day. But with one of the law firms, I was on a business trip to New York when I was still a student. I was quite active as a student in different societies, both more on the social and more on the content side. And then the law firm basically asked me, so I studied in Groningen in the northern part of the Netherlands, and most of the students in Groningen are more known for their enjoying student life part of their student time than on being so much driven to get a very good job very soon. So this law firm also had difficulties finding people with good grades, good social skills, and a strong content drive. So I was on that course also the only student from Groningen. So they said, okay, we need more people like you. Where do we find that? And then I thought, okay, if they are looking for it, it apparently has value for them. So I said, okay, I can help you with that. But then, of course, it comes at a price. To my surprise, they said, okay, we can do that. So then basically I started recruiting people out of my own network who I considered good and capable for that law firm. And that was from my Hotmail address with my personal phone, and some of it was at the bar. So it was very sort of opportunity driven that I got people into that law firm. But then over time, it seemed to work quite well. I think various things in my approach and how I dealt with people, and especially, and that's also the idea behind Apollo, people considered me their peer because I went into the same law firms, I went to the same trips, so they knew, okay, he knows what he's talking about. So that's why people like working with me, and I really put emphasis on the longer term relationship. I think in one of your previous podcasts, you also discussed the customer lifetime perspective, which is often overlooked in recruitment. So I think there was a combination of things that attracted me with the opportunity. And then at some point, I noticed that the company was actually making quite good money. So then I considered continuing that directly out of university. But I still thought like having a normal job would have value for me. So I went into international strategy consulting because I thought, okay, I will see a lot of industries. I will have a lot of exposure to very interesting clients, see how businesses are run, etc. And I thought I'd keep my business on the side. And even though the working hours in consulting are very bad, I still managed to keep this on the side. I liked doing it on the side. Then went to INSEAD, and after INSEAD or at INSEAD, I thought, okay, because the company paid for my MBA. So I thought, okay, I need to go back for some time to ensure this debt is paid off. And I thought I could still learn a lot at the company. And I liked it, but I decided, okay, I don't want to be a partner in here. I want to see whether I can be an entrepreneur, because many people say, okay, I think I can start a business and I think I can be successful. And I had this business, which was doing okay. But it's easy to say, okay, I could have made a business out of it, but you can only find out by trying. So I thought, okay, after INSEAD, I go back and then I will try to see whether this business can really work and whether I can get it flying. And I had a standing return offer, etc. So in the end, and then it already made quite a decent living. So we discussed it also before. I thought at that time it was a big step. In retrospect, I think it was actually a very small step because recruitment is also not very capital intense. So then I went out and started this first business of mine, Legal Top Talent. I expanded it. I hired a general manager to further strengthen the business and really manage the business. And for myself, I then, if you have the time, then you see so many different opportunities. So actually, and because I was in recruitment, I saw a lot of opportunities in recruitment. And that's basically how first the legal bench got going, because I saw, okay, many people leave law firms again, but they leave law firms and not necessarily because they don't like the work, but most of it because they don't like the environment and the hours that they work and how they're pushed, and how in professional service firms, they say people are our most important assets, but they treat them as assets and not as people. And with the legal bench, we thought, okay, you have these very capable lawyers that like the work of, like doing the work of being a lawyer, but don't want to be in that firm. And on the other side, you have these clients that want high quality lawyers, but don't always, or preferably don't want to pay what they are paying their very expensive law firms. So what if we get the people from those very expensive law firms who are not there anymore, but got the education, to those clients, that would be a more efficient market. So that business started.
Got it. So you were placing contract lawyers not with the law firms. You were placing them with corporate clients.
It's a combination because because as the law firms are losing so many people because they are not capable of retaining them, and sometimes they come back to us and say, okay, yeah, those people that are working as a contract lawyer now, actually, we have a shortage in our own teams. Could we get one of your people in our team? So they are also our clients, but I think partly they are our clients because they are not good at managing their internal human capital.
Right. Interesting. So, Martin, I've never met anybody who started a recruitment business as a side hustle while at university and then continued. So you're working full time as a strategy consultant and you kept your recruiting sort of thing as a sideline initially.
Yeah. So I did it in the weekends. And when I was, so I was one of the people who didn't mind really the traveling, etc. So when I was on an international assignment that was somewhere else in the world, it was also quite okay for me because then you had limited social distraction. So I had more time to work on my business.
Wow. So interesting. Now, these different businesses, are they really sort of, I'm trying to understand the structure, because are they really just different brands with the same team, or are they completely kind of different companies with different people working at them?
Yeah. So it's mostly, so Legal Top Talent and the Legal Bench are sort of in a way related, that the first one gets people into law firms and the second one gets people out of law firms.
Okay.
He would say it's very direct. They have different teams, different people. Then I started Consultancy Exit, which was basically meant to find new jobs for former top tier strategy consultants. That's the firm where we started hiring people with a business background. But because we hire people with a business background, we fairly quickly got the question from private equity firms and venture capital firms, saying, hey, you are one of the first search companies in the Netherlands where we don't pay the like really high-end executive search fees of the major international players, but where we do get the people with a business background. So if we explain to you guys our portfolio after the conversation, you still remember what the portfolio is and you understand what the challenges are. So couldn't you also help us with the managerial roles in your portfolio? Because we like working with you guys and we think you understand what we're doing. So then we started to do CEO, CFO, COO, CMO, CCO level searches, but all from the brand Consultancy Exit. But then you start to get referrals, and then you get a referral. So someone says, okay, I'm looking for a CFO. And one of our clients would say, okay, you should contact Martin, who's at Consultancy Exit. But then the guy getting the referral would say, yeah, but I don't need a former strategy consultant. I need a CFO. And then we needed to explain, okay, the name is still Consultancy Exit, but and we do have not only former consultants, we have a large CFO pool with a relevant functional and industry background as well. So that's when at some point we swapped sort of, or we added a front end, basically, which is Apollo Executive Search. Also very interesting because if you name a business Executive Search, everyone takes it more seriously.
Sure.
Because it has Executive Search behind it. I found it very interesting when we launched the brand and we still had the same activities. I got so many connection proposals from CEOs, CFOs, COOs, etc. that I thought, okay, I'm still the same guy, but overnight I added the brand. And so Consultancy Exit and Apollo are sort of with the same team, same business owner. Apollo focuses on C-level searches. Consultancy Exit still only focuses on former strategy consultants.
Got it.
For different jobs. So that's the same team, those two. And then Matcher came out of what we noticed at Apollo. But I started Matcher with Adrian. Adrian, I first tried to recruit him for Apollo. I've known him for a long time. And I always thought he would be a good addition for one of my teams. But he wanted to be an entrepreneur, which I also understood. And then it coincided when I saw this business opportunity with Matcher. And when Adrian actually, from a different perspective, also identified that opportunity, and he said, yeah, I think because he left his previous job as a partner at a digital recruitment firm, and we were still in a lot of talks, not only for getting me into Apollo, but also on a personal level. And at some point he said, yeah, I'm looking into building a sourcing business. And then I said, well, this is very interesting because with Apollo, this is exactly what we're facing. So shouldn't we start this together?
All right. Awesome. So the Apollo executive search and consultancy exit, separate brands, different websites and so on, but they're behind the scenes, it's the same team who are filling jobs on either side.
And we have people distributed over the teams because the Apollo roles really require different profiles. Consultancy exit also still requires very strong profiles, but in the end, it's slightly different. But in the end, also it's related because private equity firms with Apollo, they might look for a new CEO, but then when the CEO starts, he or she needs an assistant to the CEO. Like a very smart guy or girl who would be able to help them on their key strategic challenges. And then consultancy exit could provide them with an assistant to the CEO, who's a former consultant and known to this boardroom work.
So it sounds from what you, in our previous conversation, Martin, that Matcher was really gaining momentum, and then COVID hit. Your biggest client was Booking.com in the travel, you know, technology space, and obviously they must have been affected. What has happened with Matcher during COVID, and how, what adjustments have you had to make?
Yeah, so indeed, we were always very happy. Booking was one of our first clients. So then we were all still figuring out the business model, what works, what doesn't work. And Booking helped us a lot in that. And I think we also helped Booking, of course. And they were a very loyal client. We had them on board for more than a year, and they were a flagship brand to us and we're still in very good relations with them. But when COVID hit and they had a huge internal recruitment team, but no roles. So when you have an internal recruitment team for whom it's a challenge of, okay, what am I going to do tomorrow? Then like your external partners is okay. But if we don't know what our own team is going to do, what are our partners going to do? So we had a lot of exposure to Booking, which was great pre-COVID, but proved a challenge during COVID. We had another large scale-up client in travel. We had Accenture, which is a global technology company, but Accenture was also hit very hard when COVID hit because many of their projects were put on hold. As everyone was managing cash flow. So that also directly proved quite a challenge for Matcher. As you said, we were having a lot of momentum. We were hiring a business developer for the US market because Adrian lives part of his time in New York. I was in New York right before Corona hit, and we had various meetings that proved very fruitful. So we thought, okay, the US is a huge market, and also resources are even more expensive. So we can be very cost efficient, but also the sourcing focus is still something that is not like very mature in the US. So we can also bring a lot of sourcing value at a competitive price level. So we thought, okay, this should be interesting. We had a lot of momentum, and we thought, okay, this is where we can grow. Then COVID hit, and as I said, we had some clients facing tough times. So then the challenge for us was, okay, we need to adapt. So now we are losing a lot of revenues. Our cost levels are the same, but we spent a lot of time training our people. We have a very capable and coherent team with, I think, a very good culture, atmosphere, etc. So we thought, okay, how long is this going to last? Because if the market picks up again, we want to have many capable people, because if our clients come back, then like in growth, you often face these challenges of, okay, so now I have a new client, but I don't have people. So it was all the time, okay, we have a new client, oh shit, but we don't have people. So now we need to find people. So in a way, we thought, okay, now we finally can have a bench, which we were never able to have. But yeah, with COVID, is it good to have a bench? And how much do you want on the bench? So we needed to make this trade-off. Okay, how many people can we keep within the team versus remaining financially stable? So this was something we really struggled with, and then we took the decision to keep on as many people as possible and invest in our people to keep them on board. I think one of the things that we did well is that ever since we started Matcher, we've always been extremely transparent to our people about how is the company doing. We shared our financial performance on a monthly basis and like everything about the financial performance. So people also understood directly what happened when COVID hit, which was also very good for their engagement. But we needed to balance, and to, as I said, we decided to keep more people on than was financially the optimal ID. And that's, I mean, laying people off during COVID when you know it will be hard for recruiters to find a new job. It's also not something that you like to do with people that's helped your company grow and help you develop your brand. Especially social security is of course also different in Ukraine than in many other countries. Fortunately, many of them quickly found a job. So in the end, that didn't turn out that bad. But it was really a struggle for us to decide, okay, how many people can we keep on and how many people do we need to let go? And then very quickly, we signed TikTok. So we were able to, some of the people we said, okay, we need to let you go. And we could say, yeah, sorry, we also didn't expect this, but we actually need you back. Are you still willing to move back? And now we see part of the market that we're serving getting in need again. So now we're hiring again, and now it proved a good choice what we did. But at that time, we of course weren't sure whether it was the right choice to keep on so many people. But now we're facing the problem again of getting clients on board and not having people, especially as we also launched the new remote hiring proposition. Which then again proved an opportunity of COVID, because Ukraine has many as a very attractive tech market. There are many very motivated, capable developers who can be hired for very reasonable prices and are very good and motivated for what they're doing. And we've told that to other companies before, like, shouldn't you build a team in Ukraine? We can help you set it up. And then they always said, yeah, no, we don't want to manage remote employees. We don't think it will work. And then COVID has started, and everyone was a remote employee. So our clients in Amsterdam with their employees living sort of 100 meters from the office were still remote employees, and people found out, especially in the tech domain, that many developers even were more productive working from home, working remote, than working in the office. So then we saw a lot of momentum for remote teams. So now we also actively moved into that space, like helping companies that now see that, hey, I can have a long time. It can take me a long time to find someone expensive, medium capable in Amsterdam, or I can find someone fast in Kiev who's more motivated at more cost efficient level. So now we help them build remote development, remote data science teams in Kiev. And we don't do outsourcing, so we don't take the outsourcing premiums. They are your employees. You manage them. You pay us a fixed fee for setting this team up, building it. We can help you with the operations, etc. But those are just your remote employees, and that's now proving something that's very valuable at these times.
Interesting. Wow. So you pivoted quickly to. Were you already planning that, or was this an opportunistic thing of, you know, helping companies set up remote teams in Kiev?
Yeah, we were planning it. We were discussing it, but also because the sourcing business was growing so fast and required so much of our attention, we spent too little time on it and just focused on the sourcing part. When COVID hit and the remote trend started and companies like Facebook, Revolut, Twitter announced how many of their staff they expected to work remote in the future, we basically got the dust from the file, as we say in the Netherlands, and we thought, okay, we still have this idea. And this could be the right moment to really execute on it. So now we're executing a survey also under C-level people from startups, scale-ups, on how and what's their view on the future of remote work. Is it something which is only stated by some of the brands and that gets a lot of marketing attention, or is it an underlying trend? And with that research, we are actively going into the market to discuss with companies, hey, we can help you build remote teams here. This is how we've done it for several other companies. These have been the learnings. If you want to build X, this is how it works. We have a report on the state of tech in Ukraine, which we can share with potential clients, which gives them the cost level, the challenges, everything, so they can very quickly see, hey, am I comfortable building a team in Ukraine? And then we can help them with it. So it was an idea that was basically activated by Corona.
So, and is this going to be part of Matcher, or is this yet another company?
No, this is all within the Matcher brand, Mark. At this point in time, I feel I have sufficient companies.
Fair enough. So I want to go back. It sounds really interesting and smart, really smart that you reactivated that idea and started marketing it straight away in light of what's happening with everyone working remotely. But I want to go back to because I think entrepreneurs who have teams and have had to either furlough people or lay people off will resonate with the part where you were talking about how difficult that was and also deciding, how many people can you keep? How many people do you need to let go? And it really affects people's, lives. It's a big responsibility. You decided to keep more people than perhaps was financially prudent, which paid off when you then won TikTok, because then you were able to ramp up quickly for that account. But what was it? And then you're going back to people you've already let go to try and say, actually, we've got a job for you after all. But were they not disenfranchised at that point? How did you win them over? Because they might have been feeling quite disappointed how did you manage that, that process?
Yeah. So as I said, and this, I mean, I'm a big fan of transparency, but especially Adrian is really the guy about culture and transparency, because in the previous firm where he was a partner in the digital recruitment firm, this was the last thing that the company was standing for was transparency. Like Adrian said, for months they would tell how everything was going extremely well at the company, and then 1 week after, people needed to be fired. And he said, "That is not what I want to build and want to be. I want our people." And I think also research has proven that transparency and having them involved in the business is also better for their engagement. Yes. And I think it's also fair to people, because they commit to a cause, so to say. So they want to know what's going on. So what really helped us there is that people knew our dependency on certain clients. They knew for Booking, Accenture, and the other companies what was the contribution to the revenues of Matcher. And also as we were growing, of course, it's always the challenge of balancing costs and revenue. So we were By the beginning of this year, we were after the first. So we had the first year in which we were loss making, and then in January we got to the point that we were operationally profitable, and people knew that. But of course, in the beginning, you're not directly extremely profitable. But it's maybe for some people, but for our company, it didn't go like that. But it grows slowly. So people knew that when we would lose clients and we would have the same cost structure, that we would be loss-making again. And people also could follow the news and know that even though we had been loss-making before, at that phase we were growing, and we were also we invested a lot in tools. We could have been profitable sooner if we wouldn't have been investing in tools. But that was something people could understand, and then they knew, okay, so this is for the time being and we can choose to be profitable. But when COVID hit, it was for everyone very hard to say, okay, when will market activity pick up again? And people also knew how uncertain it was, so that it was a totally different situation. So people knew, okay, they knew about the company that if we lose many clients, we will be loss-making. And people also followed the news, so they knew how things were going, and we directly communicated about how does it hit us. We shared, I think, fairly quickly. There was quite some research on COVID and the impact of the labor market, which we also actively shared with our team. And so our team was very involved, and they understood what was going on. So we could show them the financials and say, okay, this is what we need to do. And then we said, okay, we need to let people go. But then people could still see that the P&L was, even when we let people go, loss-making. So also the people that stayed could see, okay, they are really investing in us because they want the people, they believe in the business, and then they want the business to continue. So for people, it was sort of course, they were indeed not, if you let them go, they were not very happy, but they understood why we needed to let people go. And I think also, I think it was with Paul Hellem that you spoke on the strength of culture.
Yes.
And then that's really when we had this. So we called everyone one-on-one that we needed to let them go. And then we had a call with the whole team saying whom we needed to let go. And then everyone, including the people that were leaving, they were all wearing their Matcher t-shirts. Supporting the brand and telling us that they wanted us to go through and hoped it would work. Yeah? So there was a lot of commitment, and there has always been a lot of commitment from our people. And that's because they understood what we were doing and that this also wasn't what we wanted to do, enabled the fact that when we asked people to come back, that they came back.
Great. Wow, that must have been hard. You know, it sounds like you managed it really, really well. And as if people are willing to come back, then that it speaks, you know, to how well you managed the whole thing with being very transparent and open with people. So great. Fantastic. Martin, I could keep chatting with you. You're an interesting guy and I've really enjoyed this, but we're out of time for today. You know, please do come back, you know, again sometime, and we can talk about the next phase. You know, what the you can give me an update on what's happening at Matcher. By the way, we'll put all your contact information in the show notes at recruitmentcoach.com/podcast. But if people are listening and they're not at their computer and they want to follow up with you, what is the best way of them reaching out to you, Martin?
The best way to reach out is either by email or by phone. The email, I don't know, should I say it now or do we share it in the notes?
Either way, yeah, tell people your email address, because in fact, let me first of all make sure people know how to spell your name, because it's
exactly,
I'm not saying it right. I'm not saying it right. It's Martin with two A's, so MAARTEN. Vanderquack is three words, VANDER, capital KWAAK. All right.
Yeah.
We'll write it all in the show notes, as I said, but what's your email address, Martin?
Yeah. So if they are interested in the Matcher services, it would be Martin. So MAARTEN @Matcher.io. And if they would be interested in the Apollo services, it would be martin@apolloexecutivesearch.com. And as you rightfully mentioned, and as I know from my international activities, Martin van der Kwaak is not the easiest name to
I'm sorry. I apologize if I butchered your name. Listen, do you, one quick question. Do you have recruitment companies who use your sourcing services, or is it all kind of corporate clients?
No, we also have recruitment companies using our sourcing services. One of the clients we've been most successful with is an IT recruitment company with over 200 recruiters operating in three countries. They focus on the tech domain. I think with them, with us doing the sourcing, we got to between 3 and 5 stable hires for them per month.
Wow.
Which proved a huge value add.
But, great.
Which was ended due to internal political reasons. I know that many people within the company disagreed. But especially for the and that's also why we use it at Apollo and why we started it from Apollo, because I think especially within recruitment agencies, the recruiters are often especially good at closing deals, getting the candidate in, ensuring there's a deal, managing candidate-client interaction. And their key strength is not in the sourcing part. So if they outsource that, they can focus on getting the deal done. So especially for IT recruitment agencies, and we've worked with various of them, everyone who thinks that they are not a specialist in sourcing and want to outsource that is a potential partner for us.
Great. Okay. Well, I'll record a little commercial for you to add to this podcast, and when it's published, we can include that. But thanks again, Martin. It's been really interesting.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on the show, Mark. It was as I told you in the beginning, being on a podcast is not my my natural pick, but I really enjoyed doing it and talking to you about the businesses and the industries. And now also I really like that you're also testing the video outreach part. So I'll share the information on that with you as well. And again, thanks a lot for having me.
Oh, pleasure. Thanks again, Martin. Have a great day.
You too.